And more than a dozen years later, the big black Cadillac with the boss whipped past the schoolhouse, and then Sugar Boy really put his foot down on the gas, and we headed out, still on the almost new slab of number 58. We had done about a mile, and not a word spoken, when the boss turned around from the front seat and looked at me and said, "Jack, make a note to find out something about Malachi's boy and the killing." "What's his name?" I asked. "Hell, I don't know, but he's a good boy." "Malachi's name, I mean," I said. "Malachi Wynn," the boss said. I had my notebook out now and wrote it down, stabbing. "Find out when the trial is set and get a lawyer down. A good one, and I mean a good one that'll know how to handle it, and let him know he goddamn well better handle it, but don't get a guy that wants his name in lights." "Albert Evans," I said, "he ought to do." "Uses hair oil," the boss said. "Uses hair oil and slicks it back till the top of his head looks like a black ball on a pool table. Get somebody looks like he didn't sing with a dance band. You losing your mind?" "All right," I said, and wrote in my notebook, "Abe Lincoln type." I didn't have to remind myself about that. I just wrote because I had got in the habit. You can build up an awful lot of habits in 6 years, and you can fill an awful lot of little black books in that time and put them in a safety deposit box when they get full, because they aren't something to leave around and because they would be worth their weight in gold to some parties to get their hands on. Not that they ever got their hands on them. I never needed money that bad. But I had the habit of saving them. A man's got to carry something besides a corroded liver with him out of that dark backwood and abysm of time, and it might as well be the little black books. The little black books lie up there in the safety deposit box, and there are your works of days and hands, all cozy in the dark in the little box, and the world's great axis grinds. "You pick him," the boss said, "but keep out of sight. Put one of your pals on him, and pick your pal." "I get you," I replied, "for I got him." The boss was just about to turn around and divide his attention between the highway and Sugar Boy's speedometer when Duffy cleared his throat and said, "Boss?" "Yeah," the boss said. "You know who it was got cut." "No," the boss said, getting ready again to turn around, "and I don't care if it was a sainted uncut maiden aunt or the Apostle Paul." Mr. Duffy cleared his throat, the way he always did in late years when he was congested with phlegm and an idea. "I happen to notice in the paper," he began, "I happen to notice back when it happened, and the feller got cut was the son of a doctor up in this neighborhood. I don't recall what his name was, but he was a doctor. The paper said so. Now," Mr. Duffy was going right on talking to the back of the boss's head. The boss hadn't paid any mind, it seemed. "Now, it would appear to me," Mr. Duffy said and cleared his pipes again, "it would appear to me maybe that doctor might be pretty big around here. You know how a doctor is in the country. They think he is somebody. And maybe it got out how you was mixed up with trying to get the fellow Wynn's boy off, and it wouldn't do you any good. You know, politics," he explained. "You know how politics is. Now it..." The boss whipped his head around to look at Mr. Duffy so fast, all of a sudden there wasn't anything but a blur. It was as though his big brown pop eyes were looking out the back of his head through the hair, everything blurred up together. That is slightly hyperbolic, but you get what I mean. The boss was like that. He gave you the impression of being a slow and deliberate man to look at him, and he had a way of sitting loose as though he had sunk inside himself and was going down for the third time, and his eyes would blink like an owl's in a cage. Then all of a sudden he would make a move. It might just be to reach out and grab a fly out of the air that was bothering him, that trick I saw an old broken-down pug do once who hung around a saloon. He would make bets he could catch a fly out of the air with his fingers, and he could. The boss could do that. Or he would whip his head at you when you said something he hadn't seemed to be listening to. He whipped his head round now to Duffy and fixed his gaze on him for an instant before he said quite simply and expressively, "Jesus." Then he said, Tiny, you don't know a goddamn thing. In the first place, I've known Malachi Wynn all my life, and his boy is a good boy, and I don't care who he cut. In the second place, it was a fair fight, and he had bad luck, and when it's like that, by the time the trial comes up, folks are always feeling for the fella who's being tried for murder when he just had bad luck because the fella died. In the third place, if you had picked the wax out of your ears, you'd heard me tell Jack to prime the lawyer through a pal and get one didn't want his name in lights. As far as that lawyer knows, or anybody else knows, he's been sent by the Pope. And all he wants to know anyway is whether the foliage he gets out of it has those little silk threads in it. Is all that clear, or do you want me to draw a picture? I get you, Mr. Duffy said, and wet his lips. But the boss wasn't listening now. He had turned back to the highway and the speedometer and had said to Sugar Boy, God's sake, you think we want to admire the landscape? We're late now. Then you felt Sugar Boy take up that last extra stitch. But not for long. In about half a mile, we hit the turnoff. Sugar Boy turned off on the gravel, and we sprayed along with the rocks crunching and popping up against the underside of the fender like grease in a skillet. We left a trail of dust for the other car to ride into. Then we saw the house. It was set on a little rise, a biggish box of a house, two-story, rectangular, gray and unpainted, with a tin roof, unpainted too, and giving off blazes under the sun, for it was new and the rust hadn't bitten down into it yet, and a big chimney at each end. We pulled up to the gate. The house was set up close to the road, with a good hog-wire fence around the not-very-big yard, and with some crepe myrtles in bloom, the color of raspberry ice cream, and looking cool in the heat in the corner of the yard, and one live oak, nothing to brag on, and dying on one side in front of the house, and a couple of magnolias off to one side with rusty-looking tinny leaves. There wasn't much grass in the yard, and a half-dozen hens wallowed and fluffed and cuck-cucked in the dust under the magnolia trees. A big, white, hairy dog, like a collie or a shepherd, was lying on the front porch, a little one-story front porch that looked stuck on the box of the house like an afterthought. It looked like those farmhouses you ride by in the country in the middle of the afternoon, with the chickens under the trees and the dog asleep, and you know the only person in the house is the woman who has finished washing up the dishes and has swept the kitchen and has gone upstairs to lie down for half an hour, and has pulled off her dress and kicked off her shoes, and is lying there on her back on the bed in the shadowy room, with her eyes closed and a strand of her hair still matted down on her forehead with the perspiration. She listens to the flies cruising around the room. Then she listens to your motor getting big out on the road. Then it shrinks off into the distance and she listens to the flies. That was the kind of house it was. One time I had wondered why the boss never had the house painted after he got his front feet in the trough and a dollar wasn't the reason you got up in the morning anymore. Then I figured the boss knew best. Suppose he had painted it up. Then the next fellow down the road would be saying to the next one, "Seen old man Stark got his house painted. Yeah, putting on airs. It looks like it was good enough for him to live in all his life like it was. And his boy gets up there in the Capitol, and it ain't good enough no more. First thing you know, an old man Stark will be going to the privy in the house and making him cook cabbage out behind the barn." As a matter of fact, old man Stark was going to the privy in the house, for the boss had put in running water in a bathroom. Water pumped by a little automatic electric pump. But you can't see a commode from the road when you pass by. It doesn't hit you in the eye or run out and bite you in the leg. And what the voter doesn't know doesn't prey on his mind. Anyway, if he had painted the house, it wouldn't have made half as good a picture as it was going to make that day, with Willie and his old man on the front steps, with Lucy Stark and the boy and the old white dog.
This ends Disc 1. All the King's Men, Disc 2.
The old man was on the front steps now. By the time we got through the front gate, which had a couple of old plow points hung on a wire to pull it shut and clank to announce the visitor, and had started up the path, the old man had come out the door. He stopped on the steps and waited. Not a very tall old man, and thin, wearing blue jean pants and a blue shirt washed so much that it had a powdery pastel shade to it, and a black bow tie, the kind that comes ready-tied on an elastic band. We got up close and could see his face, brown and tooled-looking, with the skin and flesh thin on the bone and hanging down from the bone to give that patient look old men's faces have, and his gray hair plastered down on his narrow, egg-thin old skull, the hair still wet as though he had given it a dab with the wet brush when he heard the car, just to be looking right at the last minute, and slow blue eyes in the middle of the brown folded skin. The blue of the eyes was pale and washed out like the blue of the shirt. He didn't have any whiskers or mustache, and you could see that he had shaved pretty recently, for there were two or three little nicks, with the little crusts of blood on them, where the razor had got tangled in the folds of the brown, dry skin. He stood on the steps, and for any sign he gave, we might as well have been back in the city. Then the boss went up to him and put out his hand and said, "Hello, Pappy, how you making it?"
"Getting along,"
the old man said, and shook hands, or rather putting out his hand with that same motion from the elbow which old Leatherface had had in the drugstore back in Mason City. He let the boss shake it. Lucy Stark went up to him, not saying anything, and kissed him on his left cheek. He didn't say anything either when she did it. He just reached his right arm a little more around her shoulder, not quite a hug, just putting his arm there, and you could see his knobby, crooked, brown old hand, which looked too big for the wrist bone, and the hand gave her shoulder two or three little tired, apologetic pats. Then the hand dropped away and hung at his side beside the blue jean pants leg, and Lucy Stark stepped back. Then he said, not very loudly,
"Howdy, Lucy."
"Howdy, Papa,"
she said, and the hand hanging beside the jean pants jerked as though it were getting ready to reach out and pat her again, but it didn't. I suppose it didn't have to, anyway. Not to tell Lucy Stark what Lucy Stark already knew, and had known, without words, ever since the days when she had married Willie Stark, and had come out here and had sat by the fire at night with the old man, whose wife had been dead a long time then, and who hadn't had a woman in the house for a long time. That they had something in common, old man Stark and Lucy Stark, who had loved and married Willie Stark, the Willie Stark who, at that moment, when she and the old man sat wordlessly before the fire, was upstairs in his room with his face bent down over a law book, his face puzzled and earnest, and the tousle of hair hanging, and who was not with them by the fire, but was up there in that room, but not even in that room either, but in a room, a world, inside himself where something was swelling and growing painfully and dully and imperceptibly like a great potato in a dark, damp cellar. What they had in common was a world of wordless silence by the fire, a world which could absorb effortlessly and perfectly the movements of their day and their occupations, and of all the days they had lived, and of the days that were to come for them to move about in and do the things which were the life for which they were made. So they sat there in their common knowledge, while the chunk on the hearth stewed and hissed and crumbled, and were together in the downbeat and pause of the rhythm of their lives. That was what they had in common now, and nothing could take that away. But they had something else in common. They had in common the knowledge that they did not have what they had. They did not have Willie Stark, who was what they had. The boss was introducing Mr. Duffy, who was delighted to meet Mr. Stark, yes, sir, and introducing the gang who had just come up in the second car. Then the boss jerked a thumb at me and said to his father,
"You recollect Jack Burden, don't you?"
"I recollect," the old man said, and we shook hands.
We all went into the parlor, and sat around on a few pieces of stuffed horsehair furniture, which had an acid mummy smell in your parched-out nostrils, or on straight split-bottom chairs, which Old Man Stark and the boss had fetched in from the kitchen. And the motes of dust swam in the rays of light striking in, under the shades on the western windows of the room, through the one-time white but now yellowish lace curtains, which looped uncertainly from their rods like fishnets hung up to wait for mending. The gang of us sat around and moved our thighs on the horsehair or on the split bottom and stared down at the unpainted boards of the floor or at the design on the linoleum mat in the middle of the floor as though we were attending a funeral and owed the dead man some money. The linoleum mat was newish, and the colors were still bright, reds and tans and blues, slick and varnished-looking. A kind of glib, impertinent, geometrical island floating there in the midst of the cornerless shadows and the acid mummy smell and the slow swell of time which had fed into this room, day by day since long back, as into a landlocked sea where the fish were dead and the taste was brackish on your tongue. You had the feeling that if the boss and Mr. Duffy and Sadie Burke and the photographer and the reporters and you and the rest got cuddled up together on that linoleum mat, it would lift off the floor by magic and scoop you all up together and make a lazy preliminary circuit of the room and whisk right out the door or out the roof like the floating island of Gulliver or the carpet in the Arabian Nights, and carry you off where you and it belonged, and leave Old Man Stark sitting there as though nothing had happened. Very clean and razor-nicked, with his gray hair plastered down damp, sitting there by the table where the big Bible and the lamp and the plush-bound album were, under the blank, devouring gaze of the whiskered face in the big crayon portrait above the mantel shelf. Then the nigger woman brought in a pitcher of water on a tray, with three glasses, slipping her feet in old tennis shoes dryly along the boards. Lucy Stark took one glass and Sadie Burke another, and the rest of us just passed around the third glass. Then the photographer took a secret look at his watch and cleared his throat and said, "Governor?"
"Yeah," the boss answered.
"I just reckoned, if you and Mrs. Stark is rested and all." He made a sitting-down bow in the direction of Lucy Stark, a bow from the waist that was quite a feat and gave the impression he had had a couple too many for the heat and was passing out in the chair. "If you all..." The boss stood up.
"All right," he said, grinning. "I just reckon I get you."
Then he looked at his wife questioningly. Lucy Stark stood up, too.
"All set, Pappy,"
the boss said to the old man, and the old man stood up, too. The boss led the way out to the front porch. We all tailed him out like a procession. The photographer went to the second car and unpacked a tripod and the rest of his plunder and got it rigged up facing the steps. The boss was standing on the steps, blinking and grinning, as though he were half asleep and knew what kind of a dream he was going to have.
"We'll just take you first, Governor," the photographer said,
and the rest of us eased off the porch and out of range. The photographer hid his head under the black cloth, then he popped out again, all agog with an idea.
"The dog," he said. "Get the dog in there with you, Governor. You be petting the dog or something, right there on the steps. It'll be swell. It'll be the nuts. You be petting that dog. He's pawing up on you like he was glad to see you when you come home. See, it will be the nuts."
"Sure, the nuts," the boss said.
Then he turned toward the old white dog, which hadn't moved a muscle since the Cadillac pulled up at the gate and was lying over to one side of the porch like a worn-out fur rug.
"Here, Buck,"
the boss said and snapped his fingers. But the dog didn't show a thing.
"Here, Buck,"
the boss called. Tom Stark prodded the dog with his toe for a little encouragement, but he might just as well have been prodding a bolster.
"Buck is getting on," Old Man Stark said. "He ain't right spry anymore."
Then the old man went to the steps and stooped down with a motion which made you expect to hear the sound of old rusty hinges on a barn door.
"Hi, Buck! Hi, Buck!"
the old man wheedled without optimism. He gave up and lifted his gaze to the boss.
"If he was hungry now,"
he said and shook his head,
"if he was hungry, we could guile him. But he ain't hungry. His teeth gone bad."
The boss looked at me, and I knew what I was paid to do. "Jack," the boss said, "get the hairy bastard up here and make him look like he is glad to see me." I was supposed to do a lot of different things, and one of them was to lift up 15-year-old, 135-pound hairy white dogs on summer afternoons and paint an expression of unutterable bliss upon their faithful features as they gazed deep, deep into the boss's eyes. I got hold of Buck's forelegs as though I were girding myself to shove a wheelbarrow and heaved. It didn't work. I got his front end up for a second, but just as I got him up, he breathed out and I breathed in. One gust of Buck was enough. It was like a gust from a buzzard's nest. I was paralyzed. Buck hit the porch boards and lay there like the old polar bear rug he resembled. Then Tom Stark and one of the reporters shoved on the tail end, and I heaved on the front end and held my breath, and we got Buck the 7 feet to the boss. The boss braced himself, and we heaved up the front end, and the boss got a gust of Buck. That gust was enough. "God's sake, Pappy," the boss demanded as soon as he had mastered his spasm, "what you been feeding this dog?"
"He ain't got any appetite," old man Stark said.
"He ain't got any appetite for violets," the boss said and spat on the ground. "The reason he fell," the photographer observed, "was because his hind legs gave down. Once we get him prop, we gotta work fast."
"We," the boss said. "We, what the hell you mean, we? You come kiss him. One whiff of curdle milk and strip of pine tree. We, hell."
The boss took a deep breath, and we heaved again. It didn't work. Buck didn't have any starch in him. We tried 6 or 7 times, but it was no sale. Finally, the boss had to sit down on the steps, and we dragged Buck up and laid the faithful head on the boss's knee. The boss put his hand on Buck's head and looked at the photographer's birdie. The photographer shot it and said, "It is the nuts." And the boss said, "Yeah, the nuts." The boss sat there a few seconds with his hand on Buck's head. "A dog," the boss said, "is man's best friend. Old Buck, he's the best friend I ever had." He scratched the brute's head. "Yeah, good old Buck," the boss said. "Best friend I ever had. But God damn it," he said, and stood up so quick that Buck's head slid off his knee, "he don't smell a bit better than the rest of 'em."
"Is that for the record, boss?" one of the reporters asked.
"Sure," the boss said. "He smells just like the rest of them."
Then we cleared Buck's carcass off the steps, and the photographer settled into the grind. He took the boss and the family in every possible combination. Then he got his rig together and said,
"Governor, you know we want to picture you upstairs, in the room you used to have when you were a kid. It'll be the nuts." "Yeah," the boss said, "the nuts."
That was my idea. It would be the nuts, all right. The boss sitting there with an old school book in his hands. A good example for the tots. So we went upstairs. It was a little room with bare board floor and tongue-and-groove beaded walls, which had been painted yellow one time, but had the paint crazing off the wood now in the sections where any paint was left. There was a big wooden bed with a high head and foot standing somewhat off the perpendicular, and a white counterpane on the bed. There was a table, a pine table, and a couple of straight chairs, and a stove, the kind of tin stove they call a trash burner, pretty rusty now, and against the wall beyond the stove a couple of homemade bookcases crammed with books, third readers and geographies and algebras and such in one of them, and a lot of crummy old law books in the other. The boss stood in the middle of the floor and took a good look all around while the rest of us hung around the door, bunched up like sheep, and waited.
Jesus, the boss said. Put the old white thunder mug under the bed and it'll look just like home.
I looked over at the bed and the crockery wasn't there. It was the only prop missing. That and a kid with a pudgy face and freckles on his face and sandy hair falling down on his forehead, bending down at the table by a coal oil lamp, it must have been a coal oil lamp then, and a pencil in his hand, tooth marks on the pencil where he'd been gnawing at it, and the fire in the trash burner getting low, and the wind pounding on the north side of the house, pounding down off the Dakotas 1,000 miles away and across the plains, which were icy and pearl-blind with the snow, polished hard under the wind and glimmering in the dark, and across the river bottoms, and across the hills where the pine trees had stood once and moaned in the wind, but where there wasn't anything to break the wind now. The sash in the window on the north wall of the room would rattle under the wind, and the flame in the coal oil lamp would bend and shiver in what current of air sneaked in, but the kid wouldn't look up. He would gnaw his pencil and hunch down. Then, after a while, he would blow out the lamp and pull off his clothes and get into bed wearing his underwear. The sheets would be cold to the skin and stiff feeling. He would lie there and shiver in the dark. The wind would come down 1,000 miles and pound on the house, and the sash would rattle, and inside him something would be big and coiling slow and clotting till he would hold his breath, and the blood would beat in his head with a hollow sound as though his head were a cave as big as the dark outside. He wouldn't have any name for what was big inside him. Maybe there isn't any name. That was all there was missing from the room, the kid and the thunder mug. Otherwise, it was perfect. Yeah, the boss was saying, it's sure gone. But it's okay by me. Maybe sitting over running water puts phlegm in your guts, like the old folks say, but it'd sure have made learning law a hell of a lot more comfortable, and you wouldn't have to waste so much time. The boss was a slow mover. Many's the time we've settled affairs of state through a bathroom door. The boss on the inside and me on the outside, sitting on a chair with my little black notebook on my knee and the telephone ringing to beat hell. But now the photographer started arranging things. He got the boss to sit at the table and pore over a dog-eared reader, and he fired off his flash bulb and got that. And he got a half dozen more, the boss sitting in a chair by the trash burner, holding an old law book on his knees and God knows what else. I wandered off downstairs and left them preparing the documents for posterity. When I got to the bottom of the stairs, I could hear voices in the parlor, and figured it was the old man and Lucy Stark and Sadie Burke and the kid. I went out the back way to the back porch. I could hear the nigger woman puttering around in the kitchen, humming to herself about her and Jesus. I walked across the backyard where there wasn't any grass. When the fall rains came, there wouldn't be anything here but a loblolly with the crazy marks made in it by hen's feet. But it was dust now. There was a chinaberry tree beside the gate letting you into the back lot, and as I went through the gate, the berries scattered on the ground crunched under my feet like bugs. I went on down the lot, past a row of gable-shaped chicken coops, made of wood which had been split out like shingles, and set on cypress chunks to keep them out of the wet. I went on down to the barn and stable lot, where a couple of able-bodied but moth-eaten mules hung their heads in the unflagging shame of their species beside a big iron pot, the kind they used for cooking up molasses. The pot was a water trough now. There was a pipe sticking up beside it with a faucet on it, one of the boss's modern improvements you couldn't see from the road. I went on past the stables, which were built of log, but with a good tin roof, and leaned on the fence, looking off down the rise. Back of the barn, the ground was washed and gullied somewhat, with piles of brush chucked into the washes here and there to stop the process, as though it ever would. 100 yards off, at the foot of the rise, there was a patch of woods, scrub oak and such. The ground must have been swampy down there, for the grass and weeds at the edge of the trees were lush and tropical green. Against the bare ground beyond, it looked too green to be natural. I could see a couple of hogs lounging down there on their sides, like big gray blisters popped up out of the ground. It was getting toward sunset now. I leaned on the fence and looked off west across the country where the light was stretching out, and breathed in that dry, clean, ammoniac smell you get around stables at sunset on a summer day. I figured they would find me when they wanted me. I didn't have the slightest notion when that would be. The boss and his family, I reckoned, would spend the night at his pappy's place. The reporters and the photographer and Sadie would get on back to the city. Mr. Duffy, maybe he was supposed to put up in Mason City at the hotel, or maybe he and I were supposed to stay at Pappy's place, too. If they put us in the same bed, though, I was just going to start walking into Mason City. Then there was Sugar Boy, but I quit thinking about it. I didn't give a damn what they did. I leaned on the fence, and the posture bowed my tail out so that the cloth of my pants pulled tight and pressed the pint against my left hip. I thought about that for a minute and admired the sunset colorations and breathed the dry, clean, ammoniac smell, and then pulled out the bottle. I took a drink and put it back. I leaned on the fence and waited for the sunset colorations to explode in my stomach, which they did. I heard somebody open and shut the gate to the barn lot, but I didn't look around. If I didn't look around, it would not be true that somebody had opened the gate with the creaky hinges, and that is a wonderful principle for a man to get hold of. I had got hold of the principle out of a book when I was in college, and I had hung on to it for grim death. I owed my success in life to that principle. It had put me where I was. What you don't know don't hurt you, for it ain't real. They called that idealism in my book I had when I was in college, and after I got hold of that principle, I became an idealist. I was a brass-bound idealist in those days. If you are an idealist, it does not matter what you do or what goes on around you because it isn't real anyway. The steps came closer and closer, padded in the soft dust. I didn't look up. Then I felt the wire of the fence creak and give because somebody else was leaning against it and admiring the sunset. Mr. X and I admired the sunset together for a couple of minutes and nothing said. Except for the sound of his breathing, I wouldn't have known he was there. Then there was a movement and the wire shifted when Mr. X took his weight off it. Then the hand patted my left hip and the voice said, "Gimme a slug." It was the boss's voice. "Take it," I said, "you know where it lives." He lifted up my coattail and pulled out the bottle. I could hear the gurgle as he did the damage. Then the wire shifted again as he leaned against it. "I figured you'd come down here," he said. "And you wanted a drink," I replied without bitterness. "Yeah," he said, "and Pappy doesn't favor drinking. Never did." I looked up at him. He was leaning on the fence, bearing down on the wire in a way not to do it any good, with the bottle held in both hands, corked, and his forearms propped over the wire. "It used to be Lucy didn't favor it either," I said. "Things change," he said. He uncorked the bottle and took another pull and corked it again. "But Lucy," he said, "I don't know whether she's changed or not. I don't know whether she favors it or not now. She never touches it herself. Maybe she sees it eases a man's nerves." I laughed. "You haven't got any nerves," I told him. "I'm a bundle of nerves," he said and grinned. We kept on leaning against the fence, watching the light lying across the country and hitting the clump of trees down the rise. The boss leaned his head a little forward and let a big globule of spit form at his lips, and let it fall through the space between his forearms down to the bored hog trough just over the fence from us. The trough was dry, with a few odd red grains of corn and a few shreds of shucks lying in it and on the ground by it. "Things don't change much around here, though," the boss said. That didn't seem to demand any response, so I didn't give it any. "I bet I dumped 10,000 gallons of swill into that trough," he said, "one time and another." He let another glob of spit fall into the trough. I bet I slop 500 head of hogs out of this trough, he said. And, he said, by God, I'm still doing it, pouring swill. Well, I said, swill is what they live on, isn't it? He didn't say anything to that. The hinges of the gate up the lot creaked again, and I looked around. There wasn't any reason not to now. It was Sadie Burke. She was plowing her white Oxfords through the dust as though she meant business, and every time she took a stride, it looked as though she were going to pop the skirt of her blue-striped seersucker suit. She was in such a rush. The boss turned around, looked at the bottle in his hand, then passed it to me. "What's up?" he asked her when she got within 10 feet. She didn't answer right away, but came up close. She was breathing hard from the rush. The light hit her on her slightly pockmarked face, which was damp now with perspiration, and her chopped-off black hair was wild and electric on her head, and her big, deep, powerful black eyes burned right out of her face into the sunlight. "What's up?" the boss demanded again. "Judge Irwin," she managed to get out with what breath she had after the rush. "Yeah?" the boss said. He was still lounging against the wire, but he was looking at Sadie as though she might draw a gun, and he was planning on beating her to the draw. "Matlock called up, long distance from town, and he said the afternoon paper—" "Spill it," the boss said. "Spill it." "Damn it," Sadie said. "I'll spill it when I get good and ready. I'll spill it when I get my breath, if I'm good and ready, and if you—"
"You're using up a lot of breath right now," the boss said, with a tone of voice which made you think of rubbing your hand down a cat's back, just as soft.
"It's my breath," Sadie snapped at him, "and nobody's bought it. I damn near break myself down running out here to tell you something, and then you say, spill it, before I can get my breath. And I'll just tell you when I get good and ready, when I get my breath, and—"
"You don't sound exactly windbroke," the boss observed, leaning back on the hog wire and grinning.
"You think it's so damn funny," Sadie said. "Oh, yeah, so damn funny."
The boss didn't answer that. He just kept leaning on the wire as though he had all day before him and kept on grinning. When he grinned like that, it didn't do much to soothe Sadie's feelings I had observed in the past, and the symptom seemed to be running true to form. So I decorously withdrew my gaze from the pair and resumed my admiration of the dying day on the other side of the hog lot and the elegiac landscape. Not that they would have bothered about me if they had anything on their minds, neither one of them. Powers, thrones, and dominations might be gathered round, and if Sadie felt like it, she would cut loose, and the boss wasn't precisely of a shrinking disposition. They'd get started like that over nothing at all sometimes, the boss just lying back and grinning and working Sadie up till those big black glittering eyes of hers would almost pop out of her head, and a hank of her black hair would separate from the tangle and hang down by her face so she'd have to swipe it back with the back of a hand. She would say plenty while she got worked up, but the boss wouldn't say much. He'd just grin at her. He seemed to take a relish in getting her worked up that way and lying back and watching it. Even when she slapped him once, a good hard one, he kept on looking at her that way, as though she were a hula girl doing a dance for him. He relished her getting worked up all right, unless she finally landed on a sore spot. She was the only one who knew the trick, or had the nerve. Then the show would really start. They wouldn't care who was there, certainly not if I was there, and there wasn't any reason for me to avert my face out of delicacy. I'd been a piece of furniture a long time, but some taint of the manners my grandma taught me still hung on, and now and then got the better of my curiosity. Sure, I was a piece of furniture, with two legs and a paycheck coming, but I looked off at the sunset anyway.
"Oh, it's so damn funny," Sadie was saying. "But you won't think it's so damn funny when I tell you." She stopped then said, "Judge Irwin has come out for Callahan."
There wasn't any sound for what must have been 3 seconds, but seemed like a week, while a mourning dove down in the clumps of trees in the bottom where the hogs were gave a couple of tries at breaking his heart and mine. Then I heard the boss say, "The bastard."
"It was in the afternoon paper, the endorsement," Sadie elaborated. Matlock telephoned from town to let you know.
The two-timing bastard, the boss said. Then he heaved up off the wire and I turned around. I figured the conclave was about to break up. It was.
Come on, the boss said, and started moving up the hill toward the house, Sadie by his side, popping her seersucker skirt to keep up with him, and I trailing. About the time we got to the gate where the chinaberry tree was, and the berries on the ground popped under your feet, the boss said to Sadie, "Get 'em cleared out."
Tiny was figuring on having supper out here, Sadie said, and Sugar Boy was going to drive him to Mason City in time for the 8 o'clock train to town. You asked him.
I'm unasking him, the boss replied. Clear 'em all out.
It'll be a privilege, Sadie said, and I reckon she spoke from the heart.
She cleared them out, and fast. Their car went off down the gravel road with the springs flat on the rear axle, and human flesh oozing out the windows. Then the evening quiet descended upon us. I went to the other side of the house, where a hammock, made out of wire and barrel staves, the kind they rig up in that part of the world, was swung between a post and the live oak. I took off my coat and hung it on the post, and dropped my bottle into the side pocket so it wouldn't break my hip bone when I lay down, and climbed into the hammock. The boss was down at the other end of the yard where the crepe myrtles were, prowling up and down on the dusty grass stems. Well, it was all his baby, and he could give it suck. I just lay there in the hammock. I lay there and watched the undersides of the oak leaves, dry and grayish and dusty green, and some of them I saw had rusty, corroded-looking spots on them. Those were the ones which would turn loose their grip on the branch before long. Not in any breeze, the fibers would just relax, in the middle of the day, maybe, with the sunshine bright and the air so still it aches like the place where the tooth was on the morning after you've been to the dentist, or aches like your heart in the bosom when you stand on the street corner waiting for the light to change, and happen to recollect how things once were, and how they might have been yet if what happened had not happened. Then, while I was watching the leaves, I heard a dry cracking sound down toward the barnyard. Then it came again. Then I figured out what it was. It was Sugar Boy off down in the lot playing with his .38 Special again. He would set up a tin can or a bottle on a post, and turn his back to the post and start walking away, carrying his baby in his left hand by the barrel, the safety on, just walking steadily away on his stumpy little legs with his always blue serge pants bagging around his underslung behind, and with the last rays of the evening sun faintly glittering on his bald spot among the scrubby patches of hair like bleached lichen. Then, all of a sudden, he would stop walking and grab the butt of the Play Pretty with his right hand and wheel, all in one quick, awkward motion as though a spring had exploded inside him, and the Play Pretty would go bang, and the tin can would jump off the post or the bottle would spray off in all directions, or most likely. Then Sugar Boy would say, "The b-b-b-bested," and shake his head and the spit would fly. There would be a single cracking sound and a long wait. That meant he had hit it in the first try, and was trudging back to the post to set up another. Then, after a spell, there would be another crack, and a wait. Then one time there came two cracks, close together. That meant Sugar Boy had missed the first try and had got it on the second. Then I must have dozed off, for I came to with the boss standing there saying, "Time to eat." So we went in and ate. We sat down at the table, Old Man Stark at one end and Lucy at the other. Lucy wiped the perspiration-soaked wisp of hair back from her face and gave that last-minute look around the table to see if anything was missing, like a general inspecting troops. She was in her element, all right. She had been out of it for a long time, but when you dropped her back in it, she hit running like a cat out of a sack. The jaws got to work around the table, and she watched them work. She sat there, not eating much and keeping a sharp eye out for a vacant place on any plate, and watching the jaws work, and as she sat there, her face seemed to smooth itself out and relax with an inner faith in happiness, the way the face of a chief engineer does when he goes down to the engine room at night, and the big wheel is blurred out with its speed, and the pistons plunge and return, and the big steel throws are leaping in their perfect orbits like a ballet, and the whole place, under the electric glare, hums and glitters and sings like the eternal insides of God's head, and the ship is knocking off 22 knots on a glassy, starlit sea. So the jaw muscles pumped all around the table, and Lucy Stark sat there in the bliss of self-fulfillment. I had just managed to get down the last spoonful of chocolate ice cream, which I had had to tamp down into my gullet like wet concrete in a post hole, when the boss, who was a powerful and systematic eater, took his last bite, lifted up his head, wiped off the lower half of his face with a napkin, and said, "Well, it looks like Jack and Sugar Boy and me are going to take the night air down the highway." Lucy Stark looked up at the boss right quick, then looked away and straightened a salt shaker. At first guess, it might have been the look any wife gives her husband when he shoves back after supper and announces he thinks he'll step downtown for a minute. Then you knew it wasn't that. It didn't have any question or protest or rebuke or command or self-pity or whine or, "Oh, so you don't love me anymore," in it. It just didn't have anything in it. And that was what made it remarkable. It was a feat. Any act of pure perception is a feat, and if you don't believe it, try it sometime. But old man Stark looked at the boss and said, I reckoned you was going to stay out here tonight. There wasn't any trouble figuring out what he said, though. The child comes home, and the parent puts the hooks in him. The old man, or the woman, as the case may be, hasn't got anything to say to the child. All he wants is to have that child sit in a chair for a couple of hours, and then go off to bed under the same roof. It's not love. I'm not saying that there is not such a thing as love. I'm merely pointing to something which is different from love, but which sometimes goes by the name of love. It may well be that without this thing which I am talking about, there would not be any love. But this thing in itself is not love. It is just something in the blood. It is a kind of blood greed, and it is the fate of a man. It is the thing which man has which distinguishes him from the happy brute creation. When you get born, your father and mother lost something out of themselves, and they are going to bust a hame trying to get it back, and you are it. They know they can't get it all back, but they will get as big a chunk out of you as they can. And the good old family reunion, with picnic dinner under the maples, is very much like diving into the octopus tank at the aquarium. Anyway, that's what I would have said back then, that evening. So old man Stark swallowed his Adam's apple a couple of times and lifted his misty, sad old blue eyes to the boss, who happened to be flesh of his flesh, though you'd never guess it, and threw in the hook. But it didn't snag a thing, not on Willie. "Nope," the boss said, "I got a shove." "I sort of reckoned," the old man began, then surrendered and tailed off. "But if and it's business..." "It is not business," the boss said. "It is pure pleasure. At least I'm aiming for it to be before I'm through." Then he laughed and got up from the table and gave his wife a smack of a kiss on the left cheek, slapped his son on the shoulder in that awkward way fathers have of slapping their sons on the shoulder. There's always a kind of apology in it, and anybody, even the boss, who slapped Tom Stark on the shoulder had better apologize, for he was an arrogant bastard, and when his father that night slapped him on the shoulder, he didn't even bother to look up. Then the boss said, "Don't wait up," and started out the door. Sugar Boy and I followed. That was the first news I had had that I was going to take the night air. But it was all the warning you usually got from the boss. I knew enough to know that. The boss was already sitting in the front by the driver's seat when I got to the Cadillac. So I got in the back and prepared my soul for the experience of being hurled from one side to the other when we hit the curves. Sugar Boy crawled under the wheel and touched the starter, and began to make a sound like whoop, 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 a sound like an owl tuning up off in the swamp at night. If he had enough time and the spit held out, he would ask, "Where to?" But the boss didn't wait. He said, "Burden's Landing." So that was it. Burden's Landing. Well, I ought to have guessed that. Burden's Landing is 130 miles from Mason City, off to the southwest. If you multiply 130 by 2, it makes 260 miles. It was near 9 o'clock, and the stars were out, and the ground mist was beginning to show in the low places. God knew what time it would be when we got back to bed, and up the next morning to face a hearty breakfast and the ride back to the Capitol. I lay back in the seat and closed my eyes. The gravel sprayed on the undersides of the fenders, and then it stopped spraying, and the tail of the car lurched to one side, and me with it, and I knew we were back on the slab and leveling out for the job. We would go gusting along the slab, which would be pale in the starlight between the patches of woods and the dark fields where the mist was rising. Way off from the road, a barn would stick up out of the mist like a house sticking out of the rising water when the river breaks the levee. Close to the road, a cow would stand knee-deep in the mist, with horns damp enough to have a pearly shine in the starlight, and would look at the black blur we were as we went whirling into the blazing corridor of light, which we could never quite get into, for it would be always splitting the dark just in front of us. The cow would stand there, knee-deep in the mist, and look at the black blur and the blaze, and then, not turning its head, at the place where the black blur and blaze had been, with the remote, massive, unvindictive indifference of God Almighty, or fate, or me, if I were standing there, knee-deep in the mist, and the blur and the blaze whizzed past and withered on off between the fields and the patches of woods. But I wasn't standing there in the field, in the dark, with the mist turning slow around my knees and the ticking no noise of the night inside my head. I was in a car, headed back to Burden's Landing, which was named for the people from whom I got my name, and which was the place where I had been born and raised. We would go on between the fields until we hit a town. The houses would be lined up along the street, under the trees, with their lights going out now, until we hit the main street, where the lights would be bright around the doorway of the movie house, and the bugs would be zooming against the bulbs and would ricochet off to hit the concrete pavement and make a dry crunch when somebody stepped on them. The men standing in front of the pool hall would look up and see the big black crate ghost down the street, and one of them would spit on the concrete and say, "The bastard. He reckons he's somebody," and wished that he was in a big black car, as big as a hearse and the springs soft as Mama's breast and the engine breathing without a rustle at 75, going off into the dark somewhere. Well, I was going somewhere. I was going back to Burden's Landing. We would come into Burden's Landing by the new boulevard by the bay. The air would smell salty, with maybe a taint of the fishy, sad, sweet smell of the tidelands to it, but fresh nevertheless. It would be nearly midnight then, and the lights would be off in the three blocks of downtown then. Beyond the downtown and the little houses, there would be the other houses along the bay, set back in the magnolias and oaks, with the white walls showing glimmeringly beyond the darkness of the trees, and the jalousies, which in the daytime would be green, looking dark against the white walls. Folks would be lying back in the rooms behind the jalousies, with nothing but a sheet over them. Well, I'd put in a good many nights behind those jalousies, from the time I was little enough to wet the bed. I'd been born in one of those rooms behind the jalousies, and behind one set of them my mother would be lying up there tonight, with a little fluting of lace on the straps of her nightgown, and her face smooth like a girl's, except for the little lines, which you wouldn't be able to make out in the shadow anyway, at the corners of her mouth and eyes, and one bare arm laid out on the sheet with the sharp, brittle-looking, age-betraying hand showing the painted nails. Theodore Morrell would be lying there, too, breathing with a slightly adenoidal sibilance under his beautiful blonde mustache. Well, it was all legal, for she was married to Theodore Morrell, who was a lot younger than my mother and who had beautiful yellow hair scrolled on top of his round skull like taffy, and who was my stepfather. Well, it wasn't the first stepfather I had had. Then on down the row, behind its own live oaks and magnolias, there would be the Stanton house, locked up and nobody behind the jalousies, for Anne and Adam were in town now, and grown up, and never went fishing with me anymore, and the old man was dead. Then on down the row, where the open country began, would be the house of Judge Irwin. We wouldn't stop before we got there, but we'd make a little call on the judge. "Boss," I said. The boss turned around, and I saw the chunky black shape of his head against the brightness of our headlights. "What you gonna say to him?" I asked. "Boy, you never know till the time comes," he said. "Hell," he amended. "Maybe I won't say anything to him at all. I don't know as I've got anything to say to him. I just want to look at him good." "The judge won't scare easy," I said. No, I didn't reckon the judge would scare easy. Thinking of the straight back of the man who used to swing off the saddle and drop the bridle over a paling on the Stanton fence and walk up the shell walk to the veranda with his Panama in his hand, and the coarse dark red hair bristling off his high skull like a mane, and the hooked red nose jutting off his face, and the yellow irises of his eyes bright and hard-looking as topaz. That was nearly 20 years before, all right. And maybe the back wasn't as straight now as it had been then. A thing like that happens so slowly you don't notice it. And maybe the yellow eyes were a little bleary lately. But I still didn't reckon the judge would scare easy. That was one thing on which I figured I could bet. He wouldn't scare. If he did, it was going to be a disappointment to me. "No, I don't count on him scaring easy," the boss said. "I just want to look at him." "Well, goddammit," I popped out and came up off my shoulder blades before I knew it. "You're crazy to think you can scare him." "Take it easy," the boss said and laughed. I couldn't see his face. It was just a black blob against the glare of the headlights with the laugh coming out of it. "I just want to look at him," the boss said, "like I told you." "Well, you sure picked a hell of a time and a hell of a long way to go to look at him," I said, not feeling anything but peevish now, and falling back on my shoulder blades where I belonged. "Why don't you get him to see you in town sometime?" "Sometime ain't ever now," the boss said. "It's a hell of a thing," I said, "for you to be doing." "So you think it's beneath my dignity, huh?" the boss asked. "Well, you're governor, they tell me." "Yeah, I'm governor, Jack. And the trouble with governors is they think they got to keep their dignity. But listen here, there ain't anything worth doing a man can do and keep his dignity. Can you figure out a single thing you really please God like to do, you can do and keep your dignity? The human frame just ain't built that way." "All right," I said. "And when I get to be president, if I want to see somebody, I'm going to go right out and see him." "Sure," I said, "in the middle of the night. But when you do, I hope you leave me at home to get a night's sleep, maybe." "The hell I will," he said. "When I'm president, I'm going to take you with me. I'm going to keep you and Sugar Boy right in the White House so I can have you all handy. Sugar Boy can have him a pistol range in the back hall and a brace of Republican congressmen to be caddy for him and set up the tin cans, and you can bring your girls right in the big front door, and there's going to be a member of the cabinet to hold their coats and pick up hairpins after them. There's going to be a special member of the cabinet to do it. He's going to be the secretary of the bedchamber of Jack Burden, and he will keep the telephone numbers straight and send back any little pink silk articles to the right address when they happen to get left behind. Tiny's got the build, so I'm going to get him a little operation and put flowing silk pants on him and a turban and give him a tin scimitar like he was a high grand shriner or something, and he can sit on a turret outside your door and be the secretary of the bedchamber. And how you like that, boy, huh?" And he reached back over the back of the front seat and slapped me on the knee. He had to reach a long way back, for it was a long way from the front seat of the Cadillac to my knee, even if I was lying on my shoulder blades. "You will go down in history," I said. "Boy, wouldn't I?" And he started to laugh. He turned around to watch the lit-up road and kept on laughing. Then we hit a little town and beyond it a filling station and lunch stand. Sugar Boy got some gas and brought the boss and me a couple of Cokes. Then we went on. The boss didn't say another word till we hit Burden's Landing. All he said then was, "Jack, you tell Sugar Boy how to find the house, as your pals live down here." Yes, my pals lived down there. Or had lived down there. Adam and Ann Stanton had lived down there, in the White House, where their widowed father